As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Once a sports reporter, always a sports reporter. Sometimes a cynical and sarcastic sports reporter, but yeah, always a sports reporter. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome to Writer's Block for a Monday, January 27th, 2020. Yesterday was a day like, it's a day like few I can remember. Just Richard Deitch alongside me. It's one of those days people are going to look back on and they're going to remember where they were when they heard that Kobe Bryant had died in a helicopter crash along with seven other people. I was thinking, I remember hearing about Roy Halladay. And I was actually in the GO bus when I heard that, going home and got a text from somebody with the Blue Jays about it. And I can remember, I'm old enough, I can actually remember Howard Cosell telling me that John Lennon had been shot. You process all these things. But I was trying to think, Richard, about when it happened yesterday about Kobe. And, people have said that Kobe's legacy is kind of complicated. I'm not certain it's that complicated. I actually think it's pretty straightforward if you just adhere to the facts. But the first thing I thought of was, the NBA is such a global game now. I don't think people understand the significance of Kobe Bryant to the globalization of this game. I wrote that. I mean, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, they built the game. They built the NBA in the United States. But Kobe took it international. Look, you were at the Beijing Olympics, weren't you?
Yeah.
Kobe's huge.
The biggest American star by far.
Oh, by a mile. And I was thinking about Kobe Bryant and just, the stats and that. But Kobe Bryant, to me, Kobe Bryant, Lionel Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Usain Bolt are all kind of those. I mean, they were the international guys. One name. Yeah, people knew who Shaq was. Obviously, they know who Magic was. They know who Michael is. But Kobe really transcended all of those things.
Well, obviously, there's a lot to process with the death of Kobe Bryant. But first and foremost, Jeff, to follow up on what you're saying, there's not many more people on Earth who are more famous than Kobe Bryant. I mean, just think about it. If you want to make the argument to me that there are actors and actresses who are, okay, maybe. Are there politicians, like leaders of countries like Donald Trump? Yeah, I mean, maybe. But there are very few people, and you hit on this in terms of the globalization of a person, the globalization of an athlete.
I hate to reduce it to that, but a global brand.
Who are known in North America, yes. Who are known in Asia, who are known in India, who are known in Europe. And you mentioned Messi and Ronaldo, and those were two that I thought of immediately. I think Bolt is right there, but Kobe Bryant was easily, I think, one of the 10 most sort of famous or recognizable athletic figures on the planet. So first and foremost, I think one of the reasons this really hits people is just sheer magnitude of fame.
The volume of people who were touched by his death is just massive.
Massive, right. And again, we're not even talking about like individually being touched, like just who saw him play or who knew his name, what he represented. Then the tentacles continue to sort of get bigger. Kobe Bryant is still of this basketball generation, right, where Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson are past, right?
Kobe Bryant is your favorite player's favorite player.
Exactly. That's where I was getting at next, right. Is that outside of like maybe LeBron and Vince Carter and guys who are really like high 30s, early 40s, DeMar DeRozan, Pascal Siakam, Trae Young, like who's their guy? They grew up with Kobe Bryant posters on their wall emulating Kobe moves. So he has a real impact on today's game, which is why I think you obviously saw all those people playing basketball yesterday who were really impacted. So in that sense, I'm not saying he's more famous than Michael Jordan, but I think it's very fair to say he has so much more currency in the marketplace today than those guys. So that's a second reason that this is impacted. And then thirdly, and I think both of us can relate to this because we're both fathers, is the way the actual death to sort of contemplate that Kobe Bryant died with his child there and someone who just was at the start of her life, in addition to obviously those seven other people, including loss of life for young people, that's hard to process, Jeff. And I think that touches, even if you have no, I am sure in Toronto today, there are people who don't know very little about basketball, but can relate to the death of somebody on a helicopter with their daughter. So it's all of those things encapsulated, I think, which is why, lastly, I'm just sort of go on. I think this story is going to last for a while. I think this goes, like, not the intensity, let's say, every second, but I think months from now, especially, you know, as the NBA season unfolds, NBA finals, I think this is a prominent story for all of us.
Oh, look, it's, I mean, it's, I was not the world's biggest Kobe Bryant fan. I was not a Lakers fan, but yeah, it's the game that I really like is different now because of what happened yesterday.
Yeah.
And you know, a couple of things stand out to me. First of all, Kobe Bryant, his legacy on the West Coast. And because there are West Coast and East Coast guys in every sport. And I know Kobe came from Pennsylvania. It was the lower.
Right around the Philadelphia.
Right around the Philadelphia area. Exactly. But he became a West Coast guy.
I think it's actually very fair to say he's the most famous athlete in the history of Los Angeles.
Yes. And he became the guy that all the West Coast basketball players kind of glommed onto. You know, there's a significance. There's a huge significance to that. But also just the fact that and this is why one of the reasons this loss really, I think, you know, really is driven home for me. I got the sense that Kobe Bryant, father of four daughters, was really on the verge of doing something, like, meaningful seems trite. But he struck me as the type of guy whose third act, because I think there were three Kobe acts. The first act was before Eagle, Colorado, and the rape charge. And let's be clear. I mean, it went to civil court, was settled out of civil court. He apologized. He did not admit guilt. That's part of Kobe's, that's... Whether or not it's part of his legacy.
Significant part of his history.
It's a story.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think after that, that's the second act of Kobe. You know, people forget he lost McDonald's. He lost a lot of corporate sponsors as a result of that. And I think a lot of people thought, that's it. Kobe's done. Kobe went on to have a good career. Believe still married to the same woman.
Yep.
He's got four daughters. To me, that second act was, part of it comes from entitlement. It's always easy to rebound from stuff when you have a lot of money and when you're famous. Let's face it, it is. But that second act is something, and I want to talk about that in a minute. That second act is something else. And then this third act, this is what I call Kobe's third act. You know, the Oscar.
Yeah. Multimedia production company. The true, like, no prominent athlete in his sport, I would argue, had more passion and push for women's basketball. Like, a lot of legit stuff.
Yeah. All this stuff is, I think, and this goes beyond Kobe Bryant player and Kobe Bryant father even. I just think we lost somebody who could have really made a difference. Now, what I want to ask you,
Yeah. The only you could ask me this, but the only thing I want to say is you could also argue maybe it's four acts. So the first act is
18-year-old coming out of high school.
Yeah, or just I was saying, first act is prior to what he did prior to what happened in Eagle, Colorado.
That's okay.
The second act is Kobe Bryant sort of rehabbing his image and becoming a champion. I would say the third act in basketball is Kobe Bryant, like elder statesman of the NBA, the mentor of players and wise spokesman, and then fourth act father stuff. So. And if you think about it even that way, Jeff, it's amazing. Like, the guy had four acts. Most of us get one.
Yeah, and he was 43 years old.
Exactly. 41. No,
41.
41, yeah.
Who knows what the...
That's a great point.
What the future act was going to be. Eagle, Colorado. I thought about this yesterday as people were talking about Kobe's legacy and sort of the importance of Kobe. And our friend Bruce Arthur talked about this, and... I think it's an important thing to discuss. Does Kobe Bryant happen in the Me Too era? In other words, does Kobe Bryant get to rehabilitate his image? And there are people out there, they were on social media yesterday, which is another story, we'll deal with that. There are people, it's clear that for some people, Kobe Bryant hasn't rehabilitated his image.
Right.
And
then there are a lot of people who were like, how dare you mention this on the day he died?
Right.
So you have both sides.
You get both sides of it. But I want to ask you that. Does he happen now? Does he happen now?
Well, I think what would have happened if that felony assault charge, sexual assault charge happens in 2020, you have to sort of think of the world then and think of the world now. It is magnified, Jeff, to an unprecedented height given the cable channel, streaming channel, social media channel universe we live in. So the amount, if you thought the amount of coverage back then was a lot, honestly, that was a drop in the ocean.
Yeah.
Let's put Kobe Bryant as the biggest star in the NBA. It would be the biggest sports story of that year, perhaps the biggest story of the year.
Yep.
So the amount of intention and intensity on it, you have to sort of factor in as you sort of think about, okay, what would happen? Again, I think the same sort of rules would apply to the woman. I think there would be leaks. And if you remember back in that case, there were pretty gross leaks leaking her name, leaking DNA results. So my best guess there is that you may have seen the same resolution, Jeff, the Kobe Bryant and ends up settling with this woman. Let's say the criminal charges is dropped. But I think that this is where I would say it would be different. This is just my opinion. I think Kobe Bryant would be looked. I don't think there would be a fourth act in 2020 because I think Kobe Bryant would be permanently stamped as this guy. I think his basketball career would continue. I think he would have stayed with his team. I don't know if he could have been thought of as a brand ambassador after the fact. It's a hypothetical. You don't know, but I just think how we as a society look at that today, and rightly so, I don't think Kobe would come back as easily as he did from that. That's I don't know if I'm right, but that's my take. What do you think?
I was trying to think. Cristiano Ronaldo.
He's not in North America. It's a different culture.
Right. And the incident involving him was in Vegas, but he is not in North America. The other aspect of this too, it has to be said, is social media,
which would change the game.
We're going to give you a rundown of what we have today. Obviously, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Kobe Bryant. I'm really excited about the two guests we have. Jeff Perlman joins us at 3:00. He's author of The Three Ring Circus, Shaq, Kobe, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. That's coming out in 2020, and we've had Jeff on before, and it's Jeff's insight on the Lakers is on a different level, so I'm looking forward to that. Want to talk about Kobe, the opponent. Sean Devaney's author of Facing Kobe Bryant. Players recall the greatest basketball player of his generation. What was it like to play against Kobe Bryant? We will talk to Sean about that. Our Monday roundtable will be Eric Smith and Paul Jones, who did such a terrific job yesterday, and along with everybody, along with Leo and Matt, the technical people. Sherm Hamilton, all the people who were on scene in San Antonio yesterday and took part in Sportsnet's coverage, all of them did a remarkable job. And I've sort of been in that position where you've had to report on something on the spur of the moment involving life and death, and it's not easy, but the boys came through. A couple of things I want to talk about, because I believe you're on leadoff talking about the media coverage of this. I want to talk about that. But I also want to very quickly touch on the NBA's decision to play the games. See, I liked it.
Same here.
Because to me, yeah, and some people, I liked it because where else would you rather grieve than with basketball fans? And you saw the way the players took care of the moment of silence is appropriate. But that, the two 24-second violations.
Phenomenally done.
Yeah. That showed a level of
thoughtfulness.
Of thoughtfulness.
Right, of legacy, of everything.
Legacy. Yeah. Trae Young. I don't know if you saw what Trae Young did.
Yeah.
Wore the number 8
yeah.
out. I mean, all these things we saw.
I saw people on Twitter obviously saying they shouldn't play the games. It's so not thoughtful. Here's my response to that. And again, we can't know for sure, but every person who had a significant relation with Kobe Bryant, at least in terms of the media, all said the same thing. Kobe Bryant would have said, F yeah, we're playing,
yeah.
Unquestionably. And I think, to me, the way I looked at it is, I think you honor one of the greatest competitors in the history of sports' legacy by playing. Don't get me wrong. I think it was really hard for players.
And
for some players who knew him, I mean, you know, you saw like Tyson Chandler and others on the sideline.
DeMar DeRozan.
I get it. And the game, even in watching that Spurs Raptors game, Jeff, it just lacked an energy or yeah. people, you know, you felt them grieving. But I think they made the right call. I think that was, to me, that was a much better way to honor Kobe Bryant than to sort of cancel games and put a pall on, put an additional pall on everything.
You know, I remember having discussions. I've had discussions with several people over the years, and this goes back to the earthquake World Series. When is it appropriate to cancel events? When is it appropriate not to? Was it was it college football or the NFL that played right after JFK was?
The NFL did, and obviously
the NFL did.
Now that right. that, but we, I think Jeff, you, me, and you would agree that the assassination of the leader of a country is a different conversation, right?
But part of this discussion was with people in the commissioner's office was, when do you say, okay, we're not going to play? And it came in 9-11, yeah. 9-11 as well. And I thought Bud Selig put it really well. He said, you don't want to take away from the ability of the first responders to deal with the crisis. You're not going to play baseball after an earthquake in San Francisco
right.
and take 200 police officers and force them to go to a ballpark and take them away from something more serious. And I think that is the level. I hate to bring it down to that, but that is the level of decision making. If we play, are we doing greater damage to an already pre-existing situation?
That's a good way to look at it.
And again, and I know people in social media were critical. You saw shots of the various NBA. You saw people wearing Bryant jerseys. The New York Knicks, who don't do anything right, got their pregame presentation spot on with the gold and purple lighting. See, that's, to me, what you want to do in that situation. You want to give people a place to go to grieve and to have some sort of community.
100%.
And so I give the NBA a lot of credit. I'm sure there isn't a player out there who wanted to play. I give the NBA a lot of credit for making that decision.
The other thing, too, is like the notion of saying it's disrespectful to play, you shouldn't play. The problem with that idea is that, well, how far, you know, I can make the argument that it's disrespectful to play if there's a fire that killed people down the street mm-hmm. from a stadium. Like, you know, like, in a sense, it's all disrespectful. It's not important compared to real life. But at a certain point, Jeff, I'm with you. I think if I was a basketball fan yesterday and I had tickets for a game, the place I wanted to be was with other basketball
Absolutely.
Fans to talk about Kobe Bryant.
Absolutely.
To, like relive, like, the stuff that we saw him on the court. So I
not to be hackneyed, but
they made the right decision.
That's your church at that point.
They, to me, like, and I think this show is certainly has no issues or problems knocking leagues and commissioners when they screw up, but I think they made the right call. And I don't think, as some I'm sure cynics are out there thinking, well, they didn't want to redo the schedule because it's costly and travel. Nonsense. None of that stuff. Nonsense. I mean, these are billion-dollar leagues. If they have to change, they'll change. But I think they made the right call. And I will say this. I guarantee this if you're a Raptors fan. One of the things you will remember when the regular season is over in April is that first 48
Absolutely.
Seconds. That is one of the highlights of this year for the Raptors.
Absolutely. I want to continue this discussion through the break. We'll be joined by Sean Devaney. I want to talk to you about the media coverage.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't know how to feel about the fact that TMZ is probably the most reputable media establishment out there right now when it comes to these things.
They are in terms of, like, death.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but...
Famous death,
TMZ reports something, you look at it and you go...
It's true.
Okay.
The question is, as you get into, like, what... And we'll talk about this, I'm sure, after a bit, but what does a place like TMZ have the response... What is their responsibility when it comes to knowing if they know that... family members have not been notified of this.
That is, and that is a, I mean, look, as someone who's had to call up families after a plane crash when I was working at the Globe's Montreal Bureau, you phone and you hope like hell nobody's home, essentially.
You're also taught not to hold news.
But taught not to hold, but my first sports editor told me, Hal Sigurdsson, he said, And I really think it's true. He said, you know what? No one ever wins an award for being the first to report somebody's death.
It's totally correct.
He said, there is a time in your career where you will need to hold on to something until you've exhausted absolutely every avenue.
I think that
is a good rule for journalism. But we saw on social media, you know, the reports that Rick Fox was on the chopper.
There were legitimate... outlet reported that all four of Brian's daughters died.
It was one of the TV affiliates.
I mean, how on earth could you report that to the public? Jeff, I'm like the one thing it's a cliche to say the teacher in journalism school, but like the one thing, basically speaking, if you've ever worked in this business, they tell you, you cannot get death wrong.
Right.
Like you can't get that wrong.
That is.
There's no going back from reporting someone died.
No, there isn't. And, you know, look, part of me also wonders, we've seen this happen. First of all, I don't know if we can necessarily judge Twitter and social media, call it an accurate reflection of the way journalism's done now. But the other thing, too, is part of me wonders if this isn't the product of a lot. Newsrooms are small now.
I think it is.
Newsrooms are small now. And you know what? The idea used to be get it right. Then get it first.
Yep.
And if you're going to air, you know, make sure it's not a serious one. In other words, you know, have 75% facts sometimes is okay if you want to get it first, providing you're not talking about somebody's life or death. That's changed.
Shrinking newsroom. Here's the other thing, too, is when you started and when I started in this business, you always had an editor behind you who could save your ass. There's no one to save you on Twitter if you're wrong.
No, that is... That is very well said. As I mentioned, talk a lot about Kobe Bryant today. Jeff Perlman joins us at 3:00. He's got a new book coming out on Shaq, Kobe, Phil, and the crazy years of the Lakers dynasty. Eric Smith and Paul Jones will join us for a Monday roundtable. But when we come back, Sean Devaney, author of Facing Kobe Bryant, Players Recall the Greatest Basketball Player of His Generation. Sean Devaney will join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to the Writer's Block podcast with your favorite podcatcher, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Fell asleep watching SportsCenter. Woke up on some.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block. If you're listening in the radio, that's Black Mamba Freestyle.
Fabulous.
Black Mamba.
We're trying to find some. It's not hard to find songs referencing Kobe.
Kobe's been name dropped. And
what is hard is finding songs referencing Kobe that don't need to be heavily edited.
Yeah.
But anyhow, that's where we are. A reminder, Jeff Perlman, author of Three Ring Circus, Shaq, Kobe, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty, joins us at 3 o'clock, the Monday Roundtable with Eric Smith and Paul Jones, all about Kobe, 4 o'clock, right here on Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360. We will have basketball tomorrow night on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, the first Raptors home game since the passing away of Kobe Bryant. It will be the Atlanta Hawks in town to take on the Raptors. The Hawks 12-35, the Raptors 32-14 after their win over the San Antonio Spurs last night. Kobe Bryant was an opponent that other players measured themselves against. That might sound not necessarily deep and a little trite, but there are athletes in every sport that even really good athletes, even superstars, measure themselves against. Kobe Bryant was very much one of those. Sean Devaney is editor of Facing Kobe Bryant. Players recall the greatest basketball player of his generation. Sean Devaney joins us on Writer's Block. Sean, as always, it is great to talk to you. Sad day, obviously, for not just the NBA family, but for the basketball family. Now, for sports family in general, I think it's safe to say. What's the thing that stood out when, as you were putting together this project? What is the thing that stood out to you about how people viewed Kobe the competitor?
You know, it was something that I think Doc Rivers said it best, and that was during the NBA Finals in 2008, Game 6. You might remember the Celtics. The game was played in the Boston Garden at TD Garden. Celtics were up by about 40 points with, I think it was 5 minutes to go in the game, and one of Rivers' assistant coaches said, hey, we should probably take out, you know, Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen. And Doc Rivers looked at the court and pointed to Kobe Bryant and said, I'm not taking them out until Phil Jackson takes him out. You know, so even ahead by 30-something points with just a few minutes to go in what would be a Celtics championship, you know, that was sort of where Doc Rivers was coming from. And that's the thing that really stood out is, his ability, his hatred for losing and that combined with his work ethic and talent, wound up creating a pretty special player. Obviously a very talented guy, but you can make the argument that there have been other players with Kobe Bryant's talent that didn't have his mentality and didn't have his work ethic and didn't wring everything out of their talent that they possibly could have quite the way that Kobe did.
Yeah.
Sean, how many opponents did you talk to for this book, and did the opponents offer different perspectives based on when they played Kobe at Kobe's time in his career?
Yeah, it is interesting to talk to, I'm not sure exactly how many there were in it. I think it was something like 30-something. But it is interesting to think about or to take note of, guys who played against him later in his career versus guys who played against him in the early part of his career. Cedric Ceballos, for instance, who had actually briefly played with Kobe and then against him, his impression of this kid as a young guy and really brash and cocky and somebody who you kind of wanted to throw an elbow at when he came into the lane, talking about him in that context. And then Jalen Rose, and he's talked a lot about the 81-point game, of course, but one thing that stands out about the way that that Jalen talks about that 81-point game, which is, of course, 10 years into Kobe's career toward the end, more toward the height of his career, I'd say. He talked about how Kobe did not thump his chest did not was not talking trash. He scored 81 points without necessarily making it all about him. And you know, that's much different than what he was at 17 or 18 when he felt like he needed that attention. So it is interesting to talk to guys who played against him at different phases of his career and see how he matured and how he carried himself on the floor.
You know, I was listening to NBA radio today, and they had a variety of players on. They had Samaki Walker on, who played with him, with Kobe Bryant. And I think it was him, and he was talking about how opposing players used to tell him that it was so tiring to guard Kobe because he literally would shoot from anywhere. You know, I mean, he's the all-time leader in missed shots for a reason, right? Third in scoring, I think, all-time leader in missed shots. But he talked about how guys would tell him that it was just mentally and physically draining to have to be the guy who tried to contain Kobe.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to put it, because as a defender, especially as a good defender, you have certain expectations, right? You do things the right way. You have the scouting point that says, all right, if you angle this guy this way, then that's his weak hand, and he'll have to give it up. Whereas, you know, with Kobe, you could do everything the right way, and he'd still shoot, and he'd just raise up and shoot right over you. You know, that's something that defender, you know, Tony Allen, I talked to, is of course a great defender and played with that Celtics team, played a long time with Memphis as well, guarded Kobe a lot, and that's what he said, a similar thing, just how exhausting it was to try to keep up with him, because no matter, he could be, you know, 3 for 12, and then he could very well go 6 for his next 6 and finish with a pretty good game, and there just weren't many players who had that kind of capability.
Sean, in your time covering the league and obviously even editing this book, did you come across either someone or a couple of players who you felt defended Kobe better than anyone? And if they did, what did they say was their success or limited success?
Yeah, I think Tony Allen was one of them, because he had an ability to he had an ability to stick with Bryant, and he had the defensive energy to match what Bryant did offensively, and that was something. You know, Tony Allen told me that one of the things that happened to him was you know, when he came into the league, he was trying to beat Kobe. You know, he was athletic, and he had all the hops and the dunks and all that stuff. He hurt his knee in 2007 and really spent a lot of time watching the game. And as he did that, as he watched guys like Paul Pierce and guys like Kobe Bryant, he started to figure out ways he could stop them. So he really studied things that way. And when he came back, he determined that he was going to be a defensive stopper, that his offensive game with the knee injury was not going to be the same. So it does take a certain level of IQ, I think, to be able to keep up with Kobe. You also need the same energy level, and that's just something that so few defenders had that could really match him.
You know, one of the funnier clips I think about Kobe is one that wasn't that long ago, I believe, Luka Doncic talking about how they were playing a game. I think it was at the Staples Center. And he kept hearing somebody chirping at him in Slovenian. And at the end of the game, it turned out that Kobe was sitting a couple of rows behind the bench with his daughter, and he had his daughter get her picture taken with Doncic. And there's a great shot of him going over and saying to Kobe, "Was that you?" Kobe going, "Yeah, I can speak Slovenian." And they're laughing. But he was one of our greatest trash talkers, was he not?
He was, and the way he would talk trash, though, was he wouldn't so much, you know, use the foul language. He wouldn't use, you know, he would sort of have a conversation with you, the way a catcher might do with a mm-hmm. batter, and to sort of distract you and take you off your game, and then throw in some jives and some barbs as he was going along. But he would sort of have a conversation with you. You know, I heard that from multiple players, that he wasn't so much a smack talker. He wasn't going to tell jokes and things like that, or zing you with one-liners. He was kind of having a conversation with you, and because he knew the triangle offense so well, and because it's such a unique offense in terms of where it puts players, he would very often do the thing where and you know, Michael Jordan has done this, Larry Bird has done this as well. They're famous for it, where he'd say, "I'm going to go to that spot over there, and I'm going to take a jumper, and I'm going to make it." And sure enough, that's what he would do. And very often, you know, because the triangle is a little different, defenders weren't necessarily used to him winding up in that spot or how he would get there. But that's the way the play would unfold, and he would do exactly what he said. So he was a little bit of a unique trash talker. He wasn't necessarily a smack talker. He was more of a conversationalist, as a trash talker, I'd say.
A trash conversationalist.
Sean, yes. I think Jeff and I are in agreement that the magnitude of this story is going to last for a long time in the NBA. I mean, almost any time, if you're a fan, if you just watch the Lakers, you're immediately going to think of Kobe Bryant. I mean, it's mm-hmm. you know, it's, I think it's just inevitable. How do you think this story sort of impacts the rest of this regular season, as well as this postseason in the NBA? My thought was, if the Lakers sort of go very far in the postseason, I think you're going to hear this tie-in on a daily basis.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%, that they are right now, you know, the franchise that everybody's watching. You know, it was the Warriors for 5 years, and now it's the Lakers. And because of that, that's going to keep this story front and center. You know, I was thinking about that. You know, it's such a tragedy, and really it is, you know, it is a reminder of the fragility of life, and it could have happened to just about anybody. You know, anybody could get in a car accident, some kind of accident, and I just can't think of anybody who would have had the kind of impact quite like Kobe has, you know, this happening to him. It's really hard to process. You know, it's been hard for a lot of people to process, and it's going to be hard for the league to process in general. It's hard for the NBA to process. It's been hard globally to process. You see memorials to him in the Philippines, memorials to him in Italy, you know, where he grew up. You know, you just see it all over the world, and that's because it is a difficult thing to process. And the longer the Lakers stay relevant, and they'll probably be relevant at least until the end of May, then the more that this story is going to keep percolating and be front and center. So, you know, it's obviously it's a tragedy, but it's one that I think is going to take beyond this season to really kind of process and put in its proper place.
Sean, it was great of you to join us. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Sean.
Sean Devaney is editor of Facing Kobe Bryant. Players recall the greatest basketball player of his generation. Jeff Perlman's author of Three Ring Circus, Shaq, Kobe, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. That book's coming out in September 2020. He'll join us at 3 o'clock. We'll get you set for that when we come back. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
We will have the regular Monday roundtable. It will be Eric Smith and Paul Jones, fresh off their duties in San Antonio yesterday. Of course, great deal of conversation. All the conversation will be about Kobe Bryant as we continue to try to put his career and his death in context. And Jeff Perlman, author of Three Ring Circus, Shaq, Kobe, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty, which will be coming out in 2020. Jeff Perlman will join us as well, and Richard Deitch, my co-host this week. The relationship between Shaq and Kobe is kind of one of the more interesting aspects of this, isn't it? And how they went from sort of, well, Shaq's infamous... if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was Shaq's son was one of the last people to receive a DM from Kobe. I don't know. I guess they were going to set up a meeting or something, a text. They're going to set up a meeting or something like that. And they called him his uncle. And, you know, Shaq refers to Jan as his niece as well.
That relationship is fascinating in that when they were both on the Lakers, I mean, I don't think it's unfair to say they hated each other.
Yeah.
They had to coexist because they were both the star players. But Bryant was, you know, I think Bryant was pathological, Jeff, in wanting to be the quote-unquote man, right? Mm-hmm. Quote-unquote guy.
He was the most alpha of alpha males.
Shaq was already established as a star player, if not the MVP, at times in the league. And so you had this inevitable meeting of two major alpha dogs where there can be only one alpha dog. Of course, the irony of all that is if they could have figured it out, they would have won two more championships then. And this is where you get back to Eagle, Colorado. If you remember, in Kobe talking to the detectives there,
right,
said something to the effect of, well, you know, Shaq pays off all his women.
Yeah.
You know, look, is there a way we can work this out? I think Shaq was really ticked off about sort of Kobe
bringing him into
that situation. I'm not even saying Kobe was lying. You just bring him into that situation. That caused all sorts of tension between the two. And, you know, they feuded for a long time. Eventually, if you remember, Kobe was going to leave the Lakers. You remember that? If Shaq was still around, Shaq eventually left, won a championship in Miami. Kobe stayed, won without Shaq. And then I think as they just got older and Shaq left the league earlier, this is what always happens with a lot of competitive people in their 20s and 30s. They realize all that stuff is just not that important.
Yeah.
And I think they found and forged a new relationship to, like what you said, to the point where, like, Shaq, I think, is the godfather of one of Kobe's kids, and they had a pretty decent relationship.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons we wanted to talk to Jeff is because that is that, again, as I said, people have struggled in some ways with Kobe Bryant, and they've said, you know, the legacy is complicated and all that. And when they talk about that legacy being complicated, more often than not, they're talking about the rape charge allegations in Eagle, Colorado. Which, you know, to me, that's sort of reasonably straightforward how that played out. But I think Kobe being complicated has to do with Kobe the teammate, Kobe the player, Kobe the Laker. That's, I suppose, where you could look at it and go, yeah, it was complicated.
You want to? I'll give you my. It's not a perfect parallel, but this is my parallel in the modern day. I find Kobe Bryant to be a significantly more talented Jimmy Butler. I think they're very similar in their demands of excellence of their teammates, their pathological belief that they can get it done. The difference is Kobe's a much better player than Jimmy Butler and a better offensive player, but it's the same. You know, Jimmy Butler, Jeff, sort of rubs certain teammates the wrong way and then other teammates will run through a wall for him. It's Kobe Bryant.
Samaki Walker was telling a great story about, I don't think it was a playoffs. It was a regular season game. And Michael Jordan was playing for the Wizards at the time. And Michael Michael scored in this sort of unbelievable lob where the Lakers defense just collapsed. And he said that Kobe was so pissed that he refused to practice for the next 3 days. He would sit courtside while the practice went on. And this tells you how long ago it was, and bury his head in a newspaper. Nobody buries their head in a newspaper anymore. But he said Kobe would sit there during practice, read the newspaper, and he didn't talk to anybody on the team for 3 days, went out the next game and dropped 50 points. But he just talked about how Kobe hated when people messed up the basics, like get to your spot. Why are you not in your spot? And that's the other thing Samaki Walker talked about. Playing with Kobe, the one thing I learned is get to your spot. He said, that's the voice I keep hearing over and over again. Get to your spot, get to your spot, get to your spot. But he said Kobe could not... It didn't matter if it didn't impact the play he was involved in. he could see what had happened, and it used to just piss him off when guys didn't do the basics.
And we're going to get, understandably, a lot of Kobe Bryant remembrances that are positive and talk about just sort of the ultimate competitor, et cetera. That guy was a pain in the ass to coach. And if you're going to sort of give a full transcription of his life,
yeah,
not an easy guy to coach.
No.
And compared to some of the greats of the game, I'd say incredibly hard to coach compared to him.
Oh, he'd be right up there. Yeah. He might be at the top.
Now, when you win, you get away with it.
Exactly. Jeff Perlman's author of Three Ring Circus, Shaq, Kobe, Phil, in the crazy years of the Lakers dynasty. He joins us. Why we call it writer's block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Missed an episode of Writer's Block? Listen to every episode and subscribe with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. If job requirements included having triggered a tantrum by a pompous, angry, multi-million dollar athlete, they'd be unbelievably overqualified for the job. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A reminder that we have your chance to win a trip, including hotel accommodations, to see both Toronto teams back-to-back in April 2020 and to get admission to the Hockey Hall of Fame with our VTech Wake Up Call contest. You can also win a $500 prize pack every week. Give us a call at 416-413-4141. Leave us your best Toronto sports opinion and set your alarms for 8:20 a.m. every Friday morning for the VTech Wake Up Call on Lead Off with Ashley, Ziggy, and Scotty Mack. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for details. A reminder as well that if you want to catch this show on podcast, our podcasts are usually up around, they're usually up within like 20 minutes of the show ending. So 5 o'clock, we'll have the whole shooter up for you. We touched a little bit in the previous hour on the Shaq-Kobe relationship, and specifically the Shaq-Kobe relationship while they were together with the LA Lakers. Our next guest is Jeff Perlman. He's author of Three Ring Circus, Shaq, Kobe, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. The book will be out in 2020, one of our favorites, and we're pleased to be joined by Jeff Perlman. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today. Always great to talk to you. You know your way around an NBA locker room. You know, do you have a Kobe story? Something that kind of sticks out. You know, when somebody asks you your first thoughts of Kobe Bryant, what comes to your mind?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff. He's a very complicated guy and a very unique figure. You know, when someone dies, you rightly. We focused on the positive and the glowing, and Kobe was complicated. He was a complicated teammate. I mean, back in, he was on the, so he was drafted in 96 and he played in the Lakers summer league team in 96. And, that was coached by Larry Drew, who was an assistant coach to Dale Harris. And the next year, Dale Harris coached the summer league team and Kobe played again. You know, he was only 19 years old. And one of the guys on that team playing in the summer with the Lakers was Jimmy King, the former Fab Five guy, Jimmy King. And Kobe just decided he was going to eat Jimmy King alive. Like, he just decided Jimmy King was the guy he was going to go after. Because Jimmy King was Fab Five. He'd had all this success and the headlines and the baggy shorts. And he was going to go after Jimmy King. And one guy after another who I interviewed for the book talked about Kobe just devastatingly destroying Jimmy King. Like, telling him, talking nonstop traps to him at all moments. Telling him how bad he was, if he couldn't hit an open jumper. Just he would always find that guy. Like, years later, the Lakers signed J.R. Ryder after he had played in Portland. And that was his guy. He was going to go after J.R. Ryder and just destroy J.R. Ryder. And he was really good. When people stood up to Kobe, he really appreciated it. Like, he responded to that. And most guys didn't. But there was a guy, Mike Penberthy, only played a year and some change with the Lakers. And he was a guy who would stand up to Kobe. And Kobe ended up really respecting him. But guys like Jimmy King, like J.R. Ryder, who kind of wilted before him, he would just eat you alive.
Jeff, the books that you've done, on the Mets and others, your sort of process, I have great respect for it, is you really try to interview as many people as possible. And oftentimes the people who provide you with the most insight and information into a team are like the 25th person on the, you know, Ed Hearn, the 25th person on the bench. As you have been reporting this book on the Lakers, and we're not sure where you are, maybe you finished in its sort of final ending or whatever, but who are the Lakers past or present who have given you, wouldn't be present, but past, who have given you, you think, kind of unique insight into this group, including Kobe?
Well, I mean, Ken Murphy was great. J.R. Ryder was actually great. Samaki Walker, you know, there was a, if you look it up, there was a really interesting confrontation that happened between Samaki Walker and Kobe. This is kind of typical Kobe, for good and bad. They were, they used to play these shoot around games, and everyone would put in $100. It was a half court shooting contest. And the Lakers were in Cleveland. This is during the Phil Jackson years. And everyone put in their $100 and 12 guys participated and Kobe won. And on the bus, he was collecting his $100 from everyone. And Samaki Walker didn't have his $100. And he kept pestering Samaki, where's my money? And kept pestering him. And finally, Kobe punched him in the face. And this fight ensued on the bus with Samaki Walker and Kobe Bryant, where Samaki Walker actually said, "Phil, pull over the bus. Pull over the effing bus." And Phil Jackson pulls over the bus. And Samaki says, "Kobe, come on, let's go. Get off the bus. Let's go." And Kobe wouldn't do it. And later on, Kobe, Samaki, they get to the team hotel. And Samaki Walker gets to his room. And the light is blinking on the hotel phone. And it's Kobe Bryant sobbing, offering an apology, saying that he just... And, like, it really was interesting with Kobe Bryant. He was in many ways at that. I'm talking about that point, the early years of Lakers. He had a lot of insecurity. He was a young kid who was trying to sort of prove his worth. He always felt like he had to separate himself from the other guys to develop this toughness. And at the same time, he had some real insecurities and some real sort of, you know, fears of how he was coming off. He was super complex.
Jeff, I know we could probably spend all show talking about this, but tell us a little bit about the Shaq and Kobe relationship and sort of, you know, we were talking about how one of the last DMs that it looks as if Kobe sent out was to Shaquille O'Neal's son. They were talking about getting together to do something. You know, we saw Shaq on social media refer to his niece passing away in the accident as well. How did that relationship come together, come apart, and then come together again, and specifically come apart while they were teammates?
Yeah, it was a super weird relationship. As has famously been said, you know, Shaq really wanted to play this sort of big brother role. You know, he really wanted that. And Kobe just didn't feel a need for it. Kobe just felt no need for it, truly felt no need for it. And I think that really sort of offended, I was going to say wounded, but I actually think offended is a better word. Like, I think it genuinely offended Shaquille O'Neal. Like, he was this veteran who had this success in Orlando, and he was this kid who was 18, 19 years old, and he doesn't want my help? Like, you mean he doesn't want my help? And the back and forth over the years, it's really fascinating because different guys who cover that team, like J.A. Adande and Howard Beck, they said you really had to become either a Kobe guy or a Shaq guy.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go to one or the other. And that you would actually be a ping pong ball in the locker room. Like, Kobe would say something, then you would go to Shaq and tell him what Kobe said, and then you would go back to Kobe to tell him what Shaq said about what Kobe said. You were going back and forth and back and forth. And I just think what it honestly came down to was you had two very, very, very different people. And you would think Shaq, being older and more established, would be more secure. But in a weird way, Kobe was always the more secure person. Like, Kobe felt very confident in himself. He didn't need the approval of other people. It's kind of weird, but he didn't. He didn't need teammates to tell. I mean, there's a perfect example. There's a story someone told me where Shaq took the whole team out for a dinner. They were on the road, and he took the whole team to a fancy seafood restaurant for dinner. And 30 minutes after everybody sits down, Kobe walks in and gets a table for himself with a book and just listening to music on his headphones. I mean, that was very sort of the way it was. Wow.
Jeff Blair, asked, I thought, which was a really interesting question today, and I want to get your insight into this. And that's, if the Kobe Bryant, if Kobe Bryant was charged with sexual assault today in 2020, if you take that entire case in Eagle, Colorado, and you fast forward it 2 decades today in what is now a Me Too era, where people are not only cover this differently, but I think just the public thinks of this stuff, I hope, differently. Do you think Kobe Bryant, you know, my hypothesis was he certainly continues to play, but no way does he end his career with this sort of fourth act as Kobe the Noble Statesman, Kobe going on to the other businesses. I know we're asking a bit of a hypothetical, but how do you think that would have played out today in 2020?
It's we've been talking about this, my wife and I, actually, about, number one, how do you discuss this when someone dies? Because it really hangs over a big portion of my life, of his life and my research, actually. He made a remarkable comeback that I don't think you could have predicted in 2004. A remarkable comeback. There's no way anyone sitting in 2004 would think that Kobe Bryant would become what Kobe Bryant did, this sort of second act and this redemptive figure. And I sort of agree with what you're saying. I think if it happens in 2020, he becomes a pariah. And it's just a completely different story. And really, the social media factor is just plays so much more into it. And I think the woman who he allegedly raped is identified much quicker just by the nature of social media. She probably comes out. She probably is followed by, you know, it's just also more intense. And I think when you have she was outed by the National Enquirer, but it never really went mainstream. And I think nowadays those things become much more mainstream, much quicker. And it sort of changes the tone and complexion of the entire thing.
Now, Jeff, Phil Jackson coached this team. He also coached the Bulls teams and had some fairly significant personalities on those teams as well. Yeah, ask you this. Which team do you think he enjoyed coaching more?
Oh, the Bulls.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he, his relationship with Kobe was, I mean, fascinating. He wrote a book, The Final Season. I spent a lot of time with Phil. Was great for this project, like great, great. But he wrote a book, The Final Season, about that 2003-04 year. And he hated coaching Kobe Bryant that year. Mm-hmm. I mean, he came to really appreciate him later on. There's basically two different Kobe Bryants in basketball, truly. There's 96-04, and then there's a second act, the sort of Pau Gasol, Lamar Odom years. But that first fight, he wanted Kobe traded. He had a meeting with Shaq and Phil during that 2003-04 season in his hotel room where they basically said, Phil asked the two of them, can we win a championship this year with Kobe? And they both said no, you know, and he said at one point to Mitch Kupchak, if Kobe Bryant comes back next year, he meant 2004-05, I will not coach his team. And he didn't coach the team and Kobe Bryant came back. It was he never had those problems with Jordan or Pippen, not to that degree. I mean, the biggest problem he had with Pippen was the sitting out, you know, refusing to return to the court.
Right.
But otherwise, it was a pretty harmonic relationship.
Jeff, how does, in terms of your research and writing for this book, how does the death of Kobe Bryant impact that? This book's coming out in September 2020. We're now obviously in January 2020.
I'm literally writing a new prologue as we speak. I mean, it's, people asked me yesterday, how does this affect your book? And I was maybe unfairly, but offended by the question. You know, 9 people died, 13-year-old girl died, another 30. I mean, it's just, who really gives a crap about a book? But then today I was sitting down and I just thought, I can't just, because the problem is, Ritz, that like the Kobe Bryant of 96-04 isn't that likable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to remember that in many ways it was a developmental stage in his life. And I feel like with this, to just walk into a book and have, I mean, the prologue of the book is Kobe Bryant and Smokey Walker and this sort of fight they have, this, you know, it seems weird to walk into a book when Kobe Bryant just died with just this negative sort of image at the beginning.
Jeff, I want to ask you a question because you had to face this, and this is a very interesting, almost newfound paradigm, and a lot of that has to do with social media. You did a book on Walter Payton in which you revealed some stuff about Walter Payton, who had maybe one of the greatest how do I sort of say? I mean, people in Chicago think he was a saint.
Sweetness was his nickname.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. Like, you know, could not have had a better reputation. But there were things about Walter Payton's personal life that were, I don't want to say complex, that, like, were not great. And so you reported this, you published it, you were accurate in it, and you faced a ton of backlash, not just from, let's say, the family members of Walter Payton and not just fans, but from some media people who were like, how dare you publish this, Jeff? And I wonder if, as people are trying to figure out how to write Kobe Bryant, what your sort of thoughts on maybe this is a little too strong, Jeff, but sort of the whitewashing of somebody's life after they die.
You see, I'm not a fan of it. It's this job. I mean, it's a pretty blessed profession, as you guys know. I mean, we have pretty good, it's a great way to make a living and it's enjoyable and most of it is fantastic. But the complicated part, when you're writing about someone like a Walter Payton or Kobe Bryant or whoever, JFK or Marilyn Monroe, is you're trying to be, not to make yourself feel overly important, but you're trying to be a historian. You know, you are. It's sports history. It's part of American history. And if you were going to write a book about Walter Payton and make him just sound like this patron saint, you wouldn't be doing a historian's job. And the same with Kobe Bryant. It doesn't mean, like, I read a piece earlier today all about the Kobe rape accusations and how we need to remember this and we can't whitewash it. And while I don't disagree with that, I don't think we need to dwell on that one day after he died. Like, I think we can get to that in 2 days, and that's completely fine. I think we have to have some sensitivity when someone passes to the family. I think that's important. But long-term view, it just comes with it, and it sucks, and it's not fun, and it leads to backlash, which I understand. Mike Ditka went on TV and said he would spit on me if I were in front of him.
That's right. I remember
that. Not fun. But it kind of comes with the turf, and you just have to deal with it.
Jeff, it was really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jeff.
Take care. Jeff Perlman's author of Three Ring Circus, Shaq, Kobe, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. That'll be coming out in 2020.
We should get Samari Walker on, man. That was
I did not hear that today.
Fascinating.
On the NBA radio interview. As I said, though, Samaki Walker was it was interesting getting a guy at that stage of his career in that position talking about what it was like to have Kobe.
Yeah.
Like driving you.
What Jeff was saying today, it's like, I really forgotten how much Phil Jackson wanted out and how much Phil Jackson wanted Kobe out.
I admit, I was not that aware of that story.
It's just interesting that, like, Kobe really, to his credit, his evolution as a person within basketball is just stunning because it's now starting to come back to me. Like, I remember that book Phil wrote. I remember Phil talking about, like, going to management and saying, it's got to be me or him. I remember Phil talking to Shaq saying, I'll get him out. I remember Kobe saying, I'm not playing with Shaq anymore. Mm-hmm. He's out of shape. He's too slow. I'm not getting him the ball. Like, it's amazing to sort of think back to that 2004, 2005, 2003 era. And then, you know, think of our last images, Jeff, of Kobe Bryant, which is everybody celebrating him hoisting up
right
50 shots, right, to get whatever is. I think did he score 16 his last game? Whatever he scored. It's a big celebration, basically.
Yeah. I like the fact that he missed more shots than anybody in NBA history.
He loved to shoot.
Well, he did. That was
I know we're going to go to break soon, but lastly, too, I was watching some highlights of Kobe yesterday, and there was one video that had Kobe sort of interspersed with Jordan. You forget how great the guy was at his prime. I mean, he was unreal. It was just, he was basically, he could dunk from the foul line. He blew by people.
Yeah.
He could shoot. He was an all defensive kind of player.
And you know what? He also come back from an Achilles injury.
Amazing.
Is remarkable. That's not, you know, for a basketball player, for any athlete, but especially a basketball player and, you know, a sport where you take a lot of pounding on your, on your legs, your ankles and your feet. That is a particularly problematic injury to have. Scott Pollard is a former NBA center. He was on those Sacramento. People are probably going to be shaking their head now, but there were some Sacramento Kings teams that were awesome. 1999, Bobby, 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, and the Kings and the Lakers, they went at it hammer and tong. They hated, they absolutely hated each other. Scott was also on the 2007-2008 Celtics team that beat the Lakers in the finals. but he didn't play in that postseason. He was an opponent of Kobe Bryant. We're going to get his take on Kobe Bryant, the player. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
I want to be the best. I want to be the best, simplest way. That's why I play the game. To be the best, you have to win. And that's what drives me,
He's the best player in the game. It's just that simple. There's nothing that Kobe Bryant can't do. He will defend your best player. He will shoot from the perimeter. He will get all in your muck. He will do whatever it takes. He is the most complete basketball player in the game today, bar none. He has an assassin's mentality.
Made this comment in earlier in the show about how Kobe Bryant was the type of opponent that other players measured themselves against. Was certainly the case, not just for individual players, but also for teams. Take, for example, the Sacramento Kings of the late 1990s, early 2000s. They had the grave misfortune of running into those great Kobe Bryant teams. They were eliminated by the Lakers in the first round in 2000. They were eliminated by the Lakers, swept, in fact, in the second round in 2001. And in 2002, they lost in seven games in the Western Conference Finals to the Lakers. So the Lakers were kind of that hump that the Kings couldn't get over. Scott Pollard's a former NBA center. He was on the Kings teams from 99 to 2002, those teams that had a great rivalry with the Lakers. He's also in the 2007-2008 Celtics team that beat the Lakers in the finals. We're very pleased to be joined by Scott Pollard. Scott, thanks very much for joining us on Writer's Block. As I mentioned, it's a difficult couple of days for the NBA family, for the sports family in general. But we've been talking today on this show about Kobe Bryant, the opponent, and we've been talking to people who played against him, and I should say we've been talking to writers who've written books about playing against him as well. What was it like to be in the same court as Kobe?
You always knew that he's going to bring it. The guy was a competitor. I caught the end of Michael Jordan's career, so I know what it's like when you're getting on the court and there's a guy on the other team that's just, you know, he's going to give it 100% all the time. And Kobe was another one of those guys. You knew he was going to bring it. You knew that excellence is always going to be his goal. He didn't take nights off. And as I heard you talking before I was alive, you know, you took me down memory lane there a little bit, how the Lakers always took care of my Kings.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, but it is true. And it was a hill we couldn't just get over. And, I mean, we had fights with them, and there was a couple bench-clearing ones. And, you know, the rivalry with the Kings and the Lakers was real. We were so familiar with them. As you said, we saw them in the playoffs every year, it seemed. And we played them in the preseason as well. I mean, that's 7-8 times a year we're seeing these people, maybe even more if it goes all the way to 7 games. So we were very familiar with them. We knew Kobe. We knew Shaq, both of them in their prime. You know, just a great, great rivalry. And, you know, that's – we all grieve differently. And, you know, right now I'm in the frame of mind of trying to remember all the great things about him because I – you know, he fits in the category of a guy I never played with. I hated playing against him. I didn't like him. And another guy like that was Reggie Miller. I hated Reggie Miller, and then I became teammates with him in Indiana. And, man, I love Reggie Miller. He's one of my favorite teammates. And Kevin Garnett is the same way. I hated Kevin Garnett. We almost came to blows once in Tokyo in a game. And, you know, then I all of a sudden I'm teammates with him on the Boston Celtics, and we're – he was one of my favorite teammates also. So I think Kobe would fit into that and just an ultimate competitor and just somebody that you always knew was going to bring it.
Scott, before I ask you a question on Kobe, I must say one of my favorite things in the NBA is Kevin Garnett swatting away shots like after a foul is called just because he never wanted anybody to be able to score a basket, basically, even after the whistle was gone. It's just a beautifully annoying thing to do to people that made KG even more of a great player. Scott, I want to ask you about...
Annoying.
Yeah, annoying as hell, exactly. I want to ask you about Kobe Bryant, because you're someone who could really speak to this. You were playing at the beginning of Kobe's career when he was very, very much a 19, 18-year-old, 20-year-old, trying to establish himself in the league, probably incredibly cocky, a lot of talking, and you saw that player sort of have multiple acts. And by the end of his career, was sort of like this elder statesman, you know, wise old man of the NBA. And so I'm wondering, could you, when you were playing against Kobe very early on, even or with those Sacramento teams, could you have imagined that Kobe was ultimately going to be the Kobe Bryant who walks away from the game as sort of this, you know, wise old man that everybody would come to for knowledge?
Well, I don't think you can ever look in a crystal ball and see a young kid at 17. He's one of those 17-year-olds that they don't exist anymore that got drafted in the NBA, and he was one of them. So, you know, when your kid is that young, I mean, I played with another one of them, it was Jermaine O'Neal. I think Jermaine still holds the record for the youngest player ever, and I don't know if that'll ever get beat. But you just can't look at a crystal ball and say, yeah, that kid's going to be an elder statesman. But I will tell you, you know, sometimes you can see talent, even if you're not on the team with him, and you can see that competitiveness. You know, early in his career, a lot of people made fun of him, and I was one of them, for just doing every single thing like Michael Jordan. He chewed his gum like Michael Jordan. He walked like Michael Jordan. He tried to do his interviews like Michael Jordan. And so, you know, I'm sure he caught a lot of that early in his career, because I think he even stated, he's like, yeah, I studied tapes of Michael Jordan. I wanted to be him. And so what made him into the elder statesman that everybody respects, including somebody like myself, that doesn't have much personal contact with him outside the game, is the fact that he was always curious, always trying to learn, always trying, you know, it didn't matter. He would go get lessons from a big man and work on his footwork, and all of a sudden he's posting people up and scoring in the post. So that's the type of thing that sets a player that, you know, maybe you last a few years in the NBA, or you're a 17-year-old kid that people are kind of making fun of, and then all of a sudden develops another facet of the game. And then next year, you develop another facet. And all of a sudden, your jumper's unstoppable because nobody can get up in you and guard your jumper because you're so lightning fast to get to the basket, and you can finish at the basket, which not everybody can do that. And he can also stop and pull up and stop short if there was a good shot blocker in there or somebody like me is going to foul him. So that's the difference between good and absolutely phenomenal. And Kobe had both. He had all of it. And, you know, he had a quote that I just read recently. It's actually beautiful. He was born with talent, and he was blessed with talent, but he still trained and practiced like he had none. And that's Kobe Bryant. I mean, he describes himself perfectly. That's him. He was born with talent, blessed with talent, blessed with ability, just genetically and health. I mean, he was hardly ever injured. That's a big factor as well. But then on top of that, he also had the drive to not take any of that for granted, not take that talent for granted like so many athletes do in all sports. When it comes easily to you, a lot of players get lazy, and they don't last because they don't train. Kobe trained like I did. Kobe trained like a guy that knew he was lucky to be in the NBA, but also knew that he could be replaced by a more talented guy at any moment. Not Kobe, me. I could be replaced by a guy at any moment. So I had to out-train everybody. I had to outwork everybody, and I had to out-hustle everybody, or I wasn't going to be in the NBA very long, and I made it over a decade. So that's why that quote specifically really spoke to me as a basketball player and gave me so much more respect for Kobe, because that is absolutely true about him, and I don't know anybody that would disagree with that, how hard he trained.
In conversation with Scott Pollard on Writer's Block, what was he like as a trash talker, and where would you rank him?
You know, I never guarded him very much.
Okay.
One-on-one. I was always the help guy. And, you know, you talk to the guys that you're familiar with and you're guarding or they're guarding you. Me and Shaq talked all the time. Sometimes it was smack. Sometimes it was just like, hey, man, you still got that motorcycle. You know, whatever. but Kobe, I didn't guard Kobe much. I do know stories from other guys that guarded him, you know, whether it was Doug Christie for most of my career in California or Ray Allen later on, and, you know, some of the guys here in Indiana where I live now that guarded him regularly. The greats all talk. Larry's legendary. Michael's legendary for talking. And so, you know, it's fun to hear those stories. I just don't have any personal ones of Kobe talking to me personally. So I don't feel it's fair to share, you know, third person.
Yep. Scott, before we brought you on, Jeff and I were talking about those Sacramento Kings teams. Bobby Jackson I loved as a player. You know, Chris Webber. These teams.
Vladdy.
These teams were awesome. And I hate to bring this up, but do you in your sleep, like, ever see that Kobe to Shaq pass in Game 7 of the 2000 Western Conference Finals? Like, that was the year I felt like the Kings were finally going to break through. And as history now shows us, every time I look, that's when they show the NBA's greatest plays, that dunk is always there. I wonder if you could just reflect on the series that you had with the Lakers and just the Kings go down as one of the great teams that were just so close. Because I think if you ever got past the Lakers, I think you would have won NBA Finals.
Yeah, that's for sure. Everybody felt that way because, you know, and I played with Brian Scalabrine in Boston a few years later, and he admitted to me that he was on the Nets at that year in 2002, and they were waiting on us because they had gone through the East. They were waiting on whoever won that series. And until Game 5, the Nets weren't even paying attention to the Lakers because they knew we were the best team. The Kings were the best team. And so they were just scouting us. They weren't even trying to get, you know, any info on the Lakers until Game 5 because they were like, oh, the Kings are going to win this one. They're the best team. So we all thought it was our year. Everybody thought it was our year. And we had a great chance. Game 6 was just awful. It looked terrible. There's a lot of question marks about that game.
Yeah. Tim Donahue game 2002. You're right. Sorry to bring that up, but our listeners should know.
Well, Tim wasn't even a ref on that game, but he did mention that game as one that he thought was fixed.
Oh, that's
he
right. You're right.
One
I'm
of the
sorry.
Referees.
You're right.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that one's debatable. But as anybody that plays professional sports, that's why they have seven-game series. You earned home court advantage. You get to go home. We got to go home for Game 7, and we crapped the bed. We did. We in our mind were thinking we're the best team in the league, and that Game 6 happened. I don't think we could shake it. We all said we did. We all said, you know what, forget it. Let's beat all eight of them. If it's the three referees and the five Lakers, then let's beat all eight of them. And we were thinking that and saying that going in, but I don't know if we felt it in Game 7 because we were awful in Game 7. I personally had a pretty good game, but I didn't sit. I sat most of the fourth quarter because Rick Adelman, as most coaches in the NBA do, go with their big money guys in the big money moments. And it was Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals, and he decided to put Chris Webber and Vlade back in the game and leave me on the bench watching, even though I had a good game up to that point. So, you know, not that I'm bitter or anything. I knew I started sounding bitter. I was like, wait a minute, let's be realistic. I knew my role on that team. And I was more than happy to watch Vlade and Chris try to do better than I could do. But we just, you know, we had Game 7 and we didn't win. And so, yeah, we were probably one of the best teams that never did it. And I did the same thing with the Pacers a couple years later in 2004. And then we had some issues and that team got broken up. And then I was on the finals team with the Cleveland Cavaliers and LeBron in 2007. And we got swept by the Spurs, and then in Boston, I was able to be a part of a team, even though I was injured in the playoffs, didn't play. You know, I got to see a team win a championship, and I got a ring for all those teams that I was on that coulda, woulda, shoulda. So I wear that ring with pride, and it's a Boston Celtics ring, but it should be a Kings ring. I should have a Pacers ring and maybe even a Cavaliers ring.
Mm. Hey, Scott, we really appreciate you joining us. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I just had to take a sip of water. I've been talking all day.
No problem. Thanks, you, Scott. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Bye. All righty. Scott Pollard, former NBA center.
You look at his career. He played for a lot of great teams.
He did play for a lot of great. I forgot. I was going through some of those names as he was talking. I forgot it was on that team. Those Kings teams.
Hey, we didn't mention Paige Stojakovic.
Didn't mention Paige was on that team.
Their shooting guard. I mean, the Kings were good. I mean, they you know, they ran into two Hall of Famers in the Lakers, but I think like...
What does that sound like, eh? Unable to get out of a conference because you're running into a team?
Yes.
What does that sound like?
Sounds like Lebronto.
Exactly.
I think 1-8 or 1-9, they were better than the Lakers. I think the problem is 1-2 was Kobe and Shaq.
Well, doing some reading on that, I mean, if they had gotten past them that year...
They would have killed the Nets.
They would have absolutely destroyed the Nets.
That was Jason Kidd and... sort of Richard Jefferson, right? And like not much else.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, the Kings would have beat the Nets. Yeah. They would have won a title. Trying to think of the others. I'm not sure I'd go with them on the Pacers. They were good, but, the Cavs got swept by the Spurs. That was a pretty good Spurs team.
Yeah.
That's like Duncan, Manu, Tony Parker in their prime.
That's a legit Spurs team. But I'm with, they should have, one of those Kings teams should have advanced.
Yeah.
One of those Kings teams should have advanced. The Monday Roundtable. Eric Smith and Paul Jones will join us. We'll get you set for it. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to the Writer's Block podcast with your favorite podcatcher, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
I got a big ego, oh, such a big ego, I got a big ego.
All right, a reminder that the Toronto Maple Leafs get back on the ice tonight against the Nashville Predators. Our Leafs Nation postgame with L. Berg and Stelic will be immediately following the Leafs Predators tonight on Sportsnet 590. The Famister Dice, you've been off for a while since you've been gone. The Leafs have, to borrow Scott Pollard's phrase, crapped the bed.
Yeah, you know, I hate when I do this, but like, because I tend to sometimes overemphasize a singular game, but we are, Jeff, getting to the point where singular games are very, very important for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Start to add up, don't they?
Yeah, they're on the outside looking in. They're not going to be fully healthy for a little bit until Morgan Riley's back.
We should add Jake Muzzin is expected to play tonight.
So, these games against like teams that are also for lack of a better phrase, bubble-ish playoff teams, you have to win. They're going to need to put together a streak, and the referendum over the next 30 plus games is really, I think, and both of us agree here, it's on Kyle Dubas. Mike Babcock's long gone. The team is what the team is. The question is, can you philosophically win with a top end roster filled with, you know, great skating and skill forwards and not more of an equal balance with defensemen. And we're going to see what the next 30 plus games is. What ultimately this comes down to.
I don't think Kyle Dubas loses his job.
No, I don't think so either. I think this is a bit of a referendum on his roster.
Fair.
But more than
that. It's a referendum, a philosophical referendum, if you want to.
But honestly, that's all nice and blah, 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 sports talk, blah, blah, blah. The season is very simple. It comes down to one thing, Freddie Anderson. If Freddie Anderson gives you essentially kind of a like a 920, 925 save percentage goalie over the next 30 plus games, you're in the playoffs. If he plays like he has over the last 2 weeks, you're out. That's it. And you have boxed yourself in, and there's probably a discussion to be had on not having a backup who you can bring in who you have any confidence in getting a winning streak. So that to me is the season. And I like Freddie and I have belief in him, but the last 2 weeks, if you're Shanahan and Dubas and Sheldon Keefe, I think would have had to scare you because it had been a long time since Freddie looked that bad.
That's kind of the, if you want to call it the third rail of Leafs fears. It's the biggie. You know, everything else, you know, guys get hurt, all that. But the big fear, if you're a Leafs fan, is that Freddie's not good anymore.
Because the whole thing is set up.
Because you can't recover from that. There's nothing you can do to recover from
that. Don't you think sort of the whole system in a way is set up for, I mean, the Leafs at their best, and I can see that the Justin Bournes of the world and Jeff Marek are far more knowledgeable on this than me. But like the setup is like to have a goalie who can face a significant amount of shots, but to limit what are really sort of the high percentage chance shots. So you're asking Freddie Anderson a lot of times, Jeff, to make 30 something saves for you to win those games with your high skill forwards. And if he lets in mediocre to bad goals, you're done. You have no chance. And so I'm really interested to see how they play against Nashville, because I think this is a the Preds are a team that are in a sort of a similar boat to the Leafs, is that there's a lot of expectations on them, and they're a couple games out of the playoffs right now. So this for them is a huge game too.
There's been a couple of baseball stories that have happened as well since we've been on the air. Nick Castellanos has agreed to a 4-year, $64 million contract with the Cincinnati Reds. There had been some suggestion, although I don't think anybody was really taking it seriously, that perhaps the Blue Jays weren't in him. Of more interest, I think, to Blue Jays fans, Starling Marte has been traded from the Pittsburgh Pirates to the Arizona Diamondbacks for a couple of prospects. Look, the Jays had interest in Starling Marte even before Ben Cherington left the Jays to go to Pittsburgh. It stands to reason that there would have been at least some discussions about Starling Marte. The Jays need a middle-of-the-order bat. They need a middle-of-the-order bat that can play the outfield better than the guys they already have. And Ben Cherington would probably know the nuts and bolts and the guts of the Blue Jays minor league system more than just about anybody. So those are two players that are off the board. And look, I'm one of the people that fully expected the Blue Jays to make an addition before spring training to bring in another outfielder, to bring in another impact bat. I didn't pretend to know how they're going to do it. I knew they weren't going to trade Nate Pearson. Obviously, you're not going to trade Bo or Vladdy. I thought maybe Kevin Biggio, maybe Danny Jansen gets you something. But I'm beginning to think now that what you see is what you get with the Blue Jays lineup, unless there's something else in the works, a relatively minor free agent signing.
What do you now, given that, why does his name escape me? Who was just named to Baseball America's top 100 prospect?
Nate Pearson. No, Simeon Woods Richardson.
Simeon Woods Richardson. Do you, and again, these are lists made up by people, so it's subjective in its own sense, but do you look at the Stroman trade now differently, given that he's now made a little bit of a rise up that chart?
Maybe. I still think, like Scott MacArthur does, that Simeon Woods Richardson is the guy that eventually gets traded by this organization
for a hitter.
For a hitter.
Okay.
But certainly he and Anthony Kay. Look, I'm excited about seeing what Anthony Kay has in spring training. I can see him making the starting rotation. If you end up with a guy making your starting rotation plus Simeon Woods Richardson for Marcus Stroman, who, Marcus Stroman probably doesn't have much of a long-term future with the Mets. I think Marcus Stroman has... It's been shown that on a very good team, he's a nice fourth or fifth starter. I don't think he's anybody's top three on a real good team. If you look at that, then yeah, it's been a really good deal. It's been it saved you some money. You've gotten rid of a headache, let's face it, and you've got one usable arm and perhaps a better arm than that in the minor league system.
Listen, I don't want to oversell what their pitching is, but Jeff, I remember us talking on air last August, or this past August, like just about like the lack of depth it felt like in terms of arms in the organization, given who they were throwing out there. And like 5 months later, like, you know, they're going to have a decent staff. They're going to have a decent staff in Buffalo. And this is not Spahn and Sain and Koufax, but they'll at least have a passable major league rotation now.
Yeah, they should be okay if Hyunjin Ryu stays healthy.
Yeah, that's pretty much the key to the team.
If not, it could look very much like last year.
Yeah, I agree.
And, as I look at this team right now, Vegas is over under number. I can't remember what it is, but I think it's pretty much
like
around
78,
okay. Someplace in that range. That's about right.
They might be, I hope it happens, but I think they're really counting on Matt Shoemaker with a pretty small sample size. That said, I loved what I saw before he got hurt. That would be a great, that guy could turn into an effective three. That would be such a huge find.
Yeah. The question is, that's fine if he's a three. If you demand more than that from him, then
I don't think they have a number two starter on this team. I don't put Tanner Roark as a number two to me. He may be on this team, or maybe Chase Anderson might be, but those guys are not, on a decent pitching staff, they're not number two.
No, there's a lot of depth starters on that, in that rotation right now.
Can you win 84 games with depth starters and Ryu?
No, not. I don't think you can, especially given your lineup.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
Again, to me, this is where, as I look at this team right now, they're incomplete. They're not good enough defensively to maximize the value of Ryu, and that lineup is still relatively easy to navigate. I have no problem with with Bo Bichette. I think Kevin Biggio is a fine player. I'm not certain he's going to give you much more than he gave you last year offensively. And, you know, Vladdy Jr. will be improved over last year. But I look at everybody else. Lourdes Gurriel Jr., if he's healthy, he can help. But I don't know if Randall Grichuk is anything more than he's shown. I know Teoscar Hernandez isn't much more than
he's
shown.
You got to hope Travis Shaw maybe just turns it around.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you're counting. You don't want to count on Travis Shaw. Travis Shaw's found money. So that's what I'm saying. They've made some nice pickups, but unless something happens to make that lineup a bit bulkier, I'm not entirely certain that on balance you end up with a much better finished product than you had last year. Eric Smith and Paul Jones were in San Antonio yesterday. The Raptors beat the San Antonio Spurs just after learning about Kobe Bryant's helicopter crash. The boys did yeoman work, and they're going to join us on the Monday Roundtable. It's Writer's Block at Sportsnet 590 Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. You choose to work with a deadline for your entire working life? You gotta be a little bit crazy. And crazy is great radio. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Look at all the technology here, man. Oh, now you're going to take the chair that's going to make you look even taller. You're supposed to. Well, this is true. This is a Monday Writer's Block. We're a mess.
Oh, look at this.
Okay, now that just looks stupid.
Like Phil Jackson.
That just looks stupid.
Jen Rolnick shaking her head, so maybe you guys aren't on.
I could do my best Phil Jackson, because my best Phil Jackson is like Charlie Chaplin. It is.
He does do a pretty good Phil Jackson, and it is on camera.
Well, there you go.
For at least the TV.
Well, God, Eric, you've grown.
For once.
It's the Monday Roundtable on Writer's Block. Paul Jones, Eric Smith. Okay, go. I've had enough. Go turn the thermostat down. Travis,
Jamaican-born, complaining about cold. It's fine.
No. We got our best person on it. Oh, sorry, we got Travis on it. Turn it down a bit.
Don't
turn it down
a bit.
There we go. Oh, Jesus.
You want a daiquiri?
With an umbrella, sure.
An umbrella, gentlemen.
You gonna fan me, Deitch?
I will fan you.
And if he asks you to start feeding him grapes and you do it, I'm just gonna end the show.
Serve him. I need a raise.
Just gonna, I'm just gonna end the show right now. With me, man.
Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. First of all, terrific work under really lousy circumstances yesterday on air with the passing away of Kobe Bryant and the seven other people in the helicopter crash.
The gate, right?
Eight other people, right. Pardon me, in the helicopter crash. What was the first inkling you had about this, Jonesy? When did you first hear it?
It trickled out. Like Eric and I were in different spots
right.
when we found out. I was back ready to go through the news conference pregame availability with Nick Nurse.
Yeah, I was standing right there, and Blake Murphy was.
You were behind me. And Blake Murphy from The Athletic said, TMZ is reporting this. And some of the other guys immediately went, they kind of brushed it off. And I went, I know they miss sometimes, but it's like the Astros, man. Like they know when the pitch is coming and they knock it out. And my first thought was, holy cow. It's probably, if they're reporting it, it's not something you just summarily dismiss. And I turned to Eric, and he was looking in his phone. I was holding the microphone. Mm-hmm. And I looked. I said, do you see this? He goes, yeah.
Well, and I Googled right away just helicopter crash Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see that part of the story was true. Because I figured if there was a small plane crash of some sort.
Somebody would have. Yeah.
It will be on the web somewhere. And immediately there were eight articles, LA Times and local, you know, CBS, Fox, ABC affiliates in LA that, you know, helicopter crash in Calabasas, in the foothills, et cetera. So you knew right away, yes, indeed, there was a crash. So now we're just dealing with, all right, is the Kobe Bryant component of it true? And that's where things kind of went from there. That was at about 1:15 San Antonio time, so I guess about 2:15 Eastern,
right.
Roughly. Because then when Nurse spoke 15 minutes later at 1:30 Central.
Because we were doing something with Matt Bonner, too, yeah, right? We had Matt Bonner lined up for pregame.
Yeah, and we didn't even ask Nurse about it because you didn't want to ask him and put him on the record
sure.
yet without another, at least one other source or one other reputable outlet reporting this just beyond TMZ. But within, 20-30 minutes, it was out.
Yeah, it was. Were you surprised the game was played? Like, was there, do you think there was a time where the game may not have been played?
I think they were taking their cue from the game that was supposed to start a half an hour before us.
Right. Okay.
Houston and the Clippers.
Right.
They were kind of waiting to see what happened there because some of the guys were visibly upset there.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into somebody from DeMar's agency in San Antonio who said, look, man, when he heard, he was a wreck. And they told him, don't play. Don't play. I mean, if you watch DeMar in the first quarter, I could have gone out there and done better.
Kyrie didn't play, right?
No. Yeah. And it's just... I thought we were close to that. The NBA might have considered it, but then you think about the logistics about the travel and mm-hmm. do we go back there and all the people that had bought tickets and all of that. And it's kind of crass, but the NBA was like, well, we'll do something about it at another time. For now, let's go ahead.
I thought that they should have canceled those two early games.
Hmm.
Only in the sense that because it was happening as those teams were taking the floor. With no disrespect to any of the other players and whatever relationships, bonds, brotherhood they had with Kobe, connections they might have had with Kobe, you're tipping off at 6, 7, 8 o'clock. You've got 3, 4, 5 hours to process. These guys, they've got 20 minutes. They've got 30 minutes. They're finding this out as they're in the locker room getting set to either, Clippers and Rockets take to the floor in 10 minutes or Raptors and Spurs take to the floor in 40 minutes. And to put that in the back of your mind, still go out and concentrate on the game, to go play the game, I was surprised that they kept... I'm not saying that they did it wrong. I can see the argument from both sides. I was just surprised that they didn't, at least for those two early games.
Yeah, listen, there's not a right answer. It's sort of ultimately subjective decision-making. Jeff and I were talking about this, and I think our thought was that I liked the decision to play. I think... it provided a place for basketball fans to sort of grieve, mm-hmm. to discuss Kobe Bryant, to be part of something bigger than them. And I don't know if this should have been a factor, but, and I'm sure both of you guys have seen this all day over the last 36 hours. Every person who interacted with Kobe Bryant, and certainly media people, all have almost universally said the same exact thing, that he would have said, you absolutely have to play.
That's why DeMar played.
And so this is what we do. So, and again, I'm not saying the NBA even went to this level, but to me, an actual tribute to that guy's competitiveness was playing yesterday, including those early games.
That was it. When after speaking to the people from DeMar's agency, they said, as hurt as he was, he said Kobe would have kicked him in the butt. Said, man, get your backside out there and play.
Right.
I mean, get out there and play. And when you talk about that. Here's a guy who tore his Achilles, stood at the free throw line, made two shots, and then walked off.
Yeah.
It's not even I made the two shots. Somebody get me a wheelchair or somebody get me a cart. He's like, no, I'm walking my backside to the locker room. And I'll be back too. And if he could have come back in that game, to come back in that game.
The 24-second stuff was remarkable. Yeah. Was that, and I forgive me, because I have not read everything that's been written on it, but I believe it was Norm said it was...
Yeah, Fred.
Fred.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Pardon me, Fred.
Said that it was Nurse and Pop that came together.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Well, Nurse had the idea, and then Fred told us that Nurse had the idea, came to the team, and then he went to Pop.
Okay. Yeah.
And I talked to my brother. I was texting with my brother last night on our flight home, and he was finishing up doing New Orleans and Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, man, the people at the network thought that was great that you guys in your game did that first, the two 24-second violations. And no time ran off the clock. So they were just over tributes, and the clock was reset to 12 minutes, and now let's play the game.
Yeah.
He said, I thought that was great because it just mushroomed. It just spread throughout the entire league.
Well, and then it changed, of course, as the day went on with the teams that did the 24-second and then the 8-second backcourt violations.
Right. Right.
Do the 24 and the 8 instead of the 24 and 24. So that was interesting.
Again, yeah. This is, you know, in terms of sort of priority, this is like, you know, number 50,020. But I'm sure both of you guys heard Mike Breen intro the Knicks game and basically talk about the fact that, like, he really had no interest in broadcasting that game. It just felt so incidental, like broadcasting the game, you say. And I wonder for you guys yesterday, I mean, you have a job to do, but it must have just been like the news of what happened in Los Angeles sort of was so immense and so overwhelming that I imagine for both of you guys, it just has to hang over everything from your game in terms of just processing it, analyzing it, interviewing players like you do, Eric, after the game. It must have just been a surreal experience.
Yeah, I was hosting the pregame show on Sportsnet yesterday. So essentially, I was the first one on camera to break the news in a sense to anybody that didn't already know it, or to kind of just set the tone that, you know, welcome to the show and we're getting you set for the Spurs and Raptors, but that's taking a back seat. For those that don't know, Kobe Bryant has passed away and died in a helicopter. And at that time, we still didn't know about Gianna. And let alone all of the others on the helicopter. And immediately it was throw it over to Sherm for his reaction. And we went from that, I think 2 minutes into the show, over to Jonesy and Jonesy gave his piece, and then over to Matt and Leo. And it just became 20 minutes, maybe 25 minutes before we went to air. Dave Leader, our producer on the TV side. We all
basically
spoke.
Had a meeting floor.
We're not doing a Raptors. You know, we all kind of talked, should we be doing like the last segment? It's like, no, there should be no segment on the Spurs and Raptors. It's all Kobe. Yep. This is just now an impromptu Kobe Bryant tribute, memorial, pregame show leading into the Spurs and Raptors, but it's all Kobe. And there was no shell of a format of topics or anything. It was just
go.
And so when they turned the mics on and I'm on, it was just Sherman and I talking from the heart. Throw over to Jonesy. Jonesy, from the heart, what are you feeling? What are you thinking? What are your memories? Over to Matt and Leo for the same thing. And there was nothing planned. And the crew in the truck, you know, Dave and Chris and Travis and John and Gavin, they were all just scrambling to grab clips and take some stuff from the San Antonio broadcast and piece together, you know, boards and graphics as quickly as they could and just kind of do it on the fly. And I thought from my standpoint, I think, Jones, you were probably the same from what you said when we went to you, is I was just kind of coming from it as a fan, as a broadcaster who's been covering the game for 20 years.
You're like,
but I was a Laker
clear
guy.
Lakers, yeah.
I was a Laker guy. I grew up in the Showtime era. That was my team. And I'd be lying if I said I didn't always keep half an eye on what Kobe was doing, what the Lakers were doing, what LeBron and the Lakers are doing now. You know, like I know we're getting to it at some point over the course of this hour.
I want half of what you get on eBay, okay? We're going to tell that story. I want half of it, okay?
There's two pieces of memorabilia that I've had signed in 20-plus years. I'm not an autograph guy, and I also think from a journalistic standpoint, integrity, yada, yeah. But I will say, unashamed, unabashed, whatever, when we're part of an 81-point game in history, and Jonesy comes to me years later and says, I think I might have an in for us to maybe get that box score autographed.
Oh, you've got
to
get it done.
100% I got that box score autographed. And that, alongside a jersey, are both framed in my office at home. But this guy forgot to bring his box score, so I got it signed by Kobe.
Let me get into the proper story. But
anyways, I'm just saying when I got to the air yesterday, it was more just speaking from the heart. And I felt that was the best way to do it because, first of all, there's never a prompter anyways. So you're always speaking from the cuff and you're ad-libbing. But it was, I'm finding out the same time as you, the audience, what's going on. I didn't know as the show starting that it was actually 9, not 5. I didn't know about Gianna. I only knew about Kobe. So everything that you're learning at home, whether it be through the television, whether it be through the phone on social media, I'm learning at the same time.
I got to say this, and not just because you guys are here, but to the folks in the production truck as well, and to Matt and Leo, the fact that you guys didn't get caught in the Rick Fox thing, because that's... So many people got caught in that.
Yeah.
And that was just, you know, we've talked about it. Like, one of the rules in journalism, you never want to be the person to get guy's death or a woman's death.
Well, I know I did not mention his daughter until it was 100% confirmed. Yeah. I just kept going. We knew it was Kobe, fine. But I didn't say anything about the daughter.
The last I heard was 5. And then when Eric and I did our hit for
Yeah, you didn't even know about to the end of the broadcast.
The end of the broadcast, because I was seeing all these, and I until I had it.
Yep.
Richard, here was my brother's tweet. He said, tonight's Boston versus New Orleans game was the most difficult game I've had to call in my 29 years at ESPN.
Wow.
Mortality is sobering. It hurts for Kobe, Gianna, and their family. I used to love hearing Kobe speak English, Spanish, Italian to the international media.
Slovenian.
And Luka Doncic, I was telling a friend of mine that Luka turns around and some guy's trash-talking his backside in Slovenian, and he turns around and it's Kobe.
And then Kobe has a picture with his daughter.
Yeah.
Taken with Doncic afterward. Doncic.
I'm like Eric. We know these guys. We see them. And, like, I'm more apt to, like, the night that Kobe had the 81, it was a Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
And we said to John Black, the Laker PR guy, so am I going to see Denzel Washington here tonight? He looked at me like I had three heads, like, dude, it's the middle of January, and you're the Raptors. Nobody's coming to see you. Everybody's skiing in Vail.
Right.
Like, just sit down and enjoy the game. You're going to get beat. Like, all this kind of implied, right? You know, and I was like, okay. And Eric and I are calling the game, and when Kobe had 40 points, they were still down 15.
Yep. Well, that's, like, go ahead. I'll let you finish.
55 and Toronto was still up 12. I'm like, we took off our heads as a timeout. I said, E, I think he could go for 60 tonight. And Eric goes, Jonesy, I think he's going for 70.
And they needed those points.
They needed those points. And it was years later when I saw him and his Nike rep, Nico Harrison. I said, look, second highest scoring game in NBA history. And like the notes in LA say, the Lakers welcome, and at the bottom of the sheet, it welcome like Paul Jones, Eric Smith, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Chuck Swirsky, Leo Routens, like NBA TV Canada, like whoever was there, you know, Michael Grange or like Doug Smith, like if you're there, they welcome you. So I've got all this in a plastic sheet somewhere. And I said to Nico, what do you think? He goes, yeah, just bring it along. We'll get it signed. I'll get Kobe to do it for you. So I go running back. I go, E, we're in. And he's like, okay. Now he starts looking for his. And in about 2013, we see Kobe. He looks at me, goes, you got it? I go, actually, no, dude, we're renovating the basement. I could barely find underwear, let alone like a box with like all this, you know, with that thing. And he's like, okay, well, we'll get it done. And it became a running joke. Like he'd come to Toronto. It's like, you got it? Like, no. Finally comes December of 2015 for his last game. And I phoned Eric that day before we left for the arena. I'm like, E, I've torn the freaking place apart. I can't find it. And he's like a kid, well, I got mine, you know, like the kid with the homework. The teacher goes, you got your homework done, Paul? No.
I did say that. I said, I'll give you a copy.
And Eric's holding up his like, oh, I got mine done.
It's interesting. I want to kind of.
So we go in the back after the game, Blair. We go in the back and Kobe looks at me. I go, sorry, man. It's in a box in a basement somewhere. And he throws his palm at me like, man, you be sleeping, man. Eric had his. And Eric got everything signed. I said, I'll have it in February. He goes, February? He goes, we ain't coming back. I'm like, the All-Star game? And his bottom lip, like my mother calls it, got like a brown turtleneck. He's like,
yes.
I'm like, you're coming back. You're going to make this. He's like, yeah, I'll be back. And I couldn't find it then either.
Before we break, because I do want to talk about you know, Kobe the player and the impact and all that. These stories to me are interesting because one of the things that I didn't, you know, I'd sort of been aware of, but I wasn't all that aware of, was the relationship he had with Cabby, Cabral Richards, who used to work at TSN. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I knew that they would always be, they do those things where they're always joking, right? Kobe didn't like to have his back patted or something like that, right? And
Cabby gets a little close.
Cabby's idea of personal space sometimes is not the same as other people's.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about this, and Richard brought this up with in conversation with Sean Devaney. Mark Spear, Woj, all I'm hearing yesterday are guys with personal stories about Kobe.
Because he was a personable guy, Blair.
But the thing is, you know, like, and
don't let that on-court stuff fool you.
He could turn it on and turn it off.
Yeah. Like you hear players say, he will go at your throat, and then you go to the free throw line, he's like, yo, E, how's the family, man? Kids good? Yeah. Like, you know the Bugs Bunny cartoon with the dog, Ralph and Sam, that like they drove together to work, but when they were at work, they were trying to like kill each other?
Yeah.
That was Kobe. Like he had the ability to do that. Like the game would be over, and he'd put that competitive guy in a box.
Yeah, the only quickly thing I'd say, Jeff, is for a star at that level, and you guys, I think, would attest to this, he was incredibly accessible to the media. That's a
very,
yeah, given his star, it's not a common thing. LeBron, though, is a little like that, too. It's
interesting. He really is, and I think the thing that stands out with both of them, and I think it was Kobe that probably started this, and LeBron has certainly either carried the torch with him or certainly carried the torch since, is unlike Michael, not only was he accessible, but he would say something. And I'm not, mm-hmm. and not just basketball related, whether it be social issues, and
yep.
standing up for, the community.
I think it was a different time for Michael though. Well, that's the prism that I put on it too. Like he was the first one with all the money and it's like, I don't know if I want to jeopardize this because he didn't know if it was
maybe so,
coming.
But there's all,
it's true.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's not true, Jonesy, yeah. but at the same time, there's also that much more pressure on today's athlete because of there's so many more people coming at them. And there's so much more spotlight that, you know,
I think though,
I would say today's athlete also has the screw you money, right? That
fair
Michael,
enough.
Michael was
and Michael
was just starting.
Michael
to get.
Didn't know if he had it,
right?
Michael didn't
right.
know. Michael couldn't be certain that all those sponsors were going to stick.
Republicans
with him.
Buy sneakers too, right?
Exactly. We'll take a break and we come back. I want to talk about Kobe Bryant's legacy and also what we may have lost yesterday. Because as I said, man, I got the impression that at his age and just. The stuff he was involved in, he was going to, you know, Kobe Act 3 or Kobe Act 4, whatever the hell it was going to be something else. We'll talk about it. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet 360.
Missed an episode of Writer's Block? Listen to every episode and subscribe with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. Oh, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block. It is the Monday Roundtable. Eric Smith, Paul Jones, Jeff Blair, and Richard Deitch. Gentlemen talking about Kobe Bryant. Richard and I made this point before in the first hour. I was in Beijing during the Olympics when Kobe was there with, I guess they called it the Redeem Team at the time. And Kobe was everywhere. I mean, he not just going to events. Mm-hmm. Like he was at women's soccer, he was at women's basketball. He was at Usain Bolt's races. Advertising everywhere, and I kind of made this point earlier today. Magic, Larry, and Michael, I think, really kind of rebuilt the foundation of the NBA in the U.S. But I think Kobe was the guy to take it international. Jonesy, I don't know how you.
I think that started. I think that started with another guy who had a lot to do with the NBA going global, David Stern, in 92. Mm-hmm. I was in Barcelona, and I remember getting a call from Scott Moore saying that I need a basketball guy. I'm like, well, what do you mean? He goes, the NBA is sending a team to the Olympics for the first time. I said, oh, okay. And I thought, you know, we're going to see some sixth or seventh man on some team. And he said, I said, what's going on? He goes, no. They're sending a Hall of Fame team. Like they basically went flea hunting with a tank.
Yeah.
Like they were tired of losing, seeing Oscar Schmidt score 47 in Indianapolis and celebrating against the college kids. And it's like, okay, no more Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah.
And like, you know, you look, they literally did send a Hall of Fame team. All those guys in the Hall of Fame, with the exception of maybe Christian Laettner in mm-hmm. the Naismith Hall of Fame. And if they would have sent Shaq, who was the other college kid they were considering, it would have been.
It's a pretty good team.
And I remember seeing, sitting with Quinn Buckner mm-hmm. At the opening ceremonies, watching world-class athletes from other disciplines hurdle barriers to get close to Magic and Larry and, mm-hmm. and Michael mm-hmm. and Barkley. And like, they were afraid. Like I could get trampled here. This could turn crazy. I think that's where it started. And then as it moved, like the progression in 96, there was that team, 94, the world champions, mm-hmm. which were in Toronto. 96, they had another team. The world's starting to catch up, but they're still standing stars. In 2000, it's Vince Carter. 2004, they finally fall off the cliff in Athens. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, okay, Jerry Colangelo decides to rebuild it. And the interesting thing in talking about that team, Blair, and because it was China and Kobe was starting to make his mm-hmm. mark, you talk to guys on that team and they say the guy that they looked to when things were tough was Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
Like you had LeBron and Wade and Dwight Howard, and like you had all the stars. Chris Paul, you had all of them. Melo, yep. But who did they look to when Spain was making the comeback? Who did they look to? Kobe got the ball.
Yeah. Yeah, I as I said, I just found it, and that was the first time I'd set foot in Asia. And I was, you know, you expect that their consumer society was just sort of blossoming at that time. But man, he was everywhere. And that's when I said, you know, to me it was Messi, Ronaldo, Usain Bolt, Kobe.
Yeah.
Those were the four guys that only needed one name.
Yeah.
Only needed one name.
Well, I was telling Jeff earlier, I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons why this is going to be a transcendent moment for so many people. You know, obviously, dying at 41 means Kobe Bryant will be perpetually young forever to us. He never gets old.
That's like Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, James Dean sort of thing.
That's it.
Deitch made that
point.
The
manner in which he died is horrific. In any of us who have children, it's incomprehensible to think about your 13-year-old dying and, you know, dying in that manner and dying with you. Like, so that touches anybody, even if you're not a sports fan. And this would be the last one. I was telling this to Jeff. Is, and I thought about this a lot last night, when you just think about the planet and famous people, known people on the planet, like Kobe Bryant is in that group of 20, 25 most famous people. I mean, like, there are a couple of sports people like Messi and Ronaldo and Jeff and I was, I don't even know if Bolt is there.
I think Bolt.
There's some singers, right? You can sort of put into that Madonna. You know, you sort of figure it out yourself. Maybe there's an actor who appears in films that play in Asia so that they have a transcendent kind of star. But this guy is on that short list. So I think, as Jeff was saying, like he has touched so many people who are just aware of him. And I was trying to think today, I mean, it's a little bit of a morbid thought, but I thought to myself, what other North American person could have passed away in that manner who might have had that impact?
LeBron's out.
Maybe. I mean, and if you eliminate, like, leaders of countries,
Tiger, Michael, LeBron, maybe.
That's it. Yeah. I could come up with, like, literally on one hand, and Tiger and Michael were part of that group.
Well, and when I was driving in, I heard you mention as well that for at least me, and it is sort of morbid to talk about, and I don't mean any disrespect, but when you think about recently, whether it be Prince or David Bowie, the last one that I remember that is global to this extent.
Michael Jackson,
and then Princess Di before that.
Yeah.
Because I tell you, I don't remember, and maybe because I wasn't personally involved, not to sound selfish about it, I don't remember what the fan did when Michael Jackson died. I remember the fan going wall to wall for at least a few hours when Princess Di passed away.
Yeah.
Like, I believe Dan Dunleavy was hosting the show, and I was kind of co-hosting slash producing with him, if I'm not mistaken, on a Sunday night. Was when she died.
Yeah.
And the fan, just like on 9/11, turned into a news station when Princess Di passed away. And that I don't recall happening with Michael Jackson. And that to me is when a moment, when you have a sports station go news.
That's a great point.
That's a big story.
And I just was going to say quickly, I think part of that is the manner in which the people died and the age at which they died. Like Michael Jackson was certainly not an old man, but he's 50.
Yeah.
Princess Di, again, like you see the image of her in your mind. She never gets old.
And
like today, when I think of Kobe Bryant, like it's like he's not so far removed.
But that's also
from playing.
And let's face it, we've all seen, you guys certainly more than us because you cover the game. But I almost feel like Kobe kind of grew up in front of us.
He was a kid.
He came in the NBA.
Absolutely. Right? He was this skinny kid that was brash without
hockey,
without without anything really to back it up, without validation or substantiation.
He didn't go to college.
And then he comes in, and Charlotte drafts him, and he gets traded to the Lakers.
Yeah,
he's Eli Manning. I'm not going to San Diego. I'm playing for the Giants. You know, like
Kobe's press conference in high school, and he had the glasses up on the forehead, and. You know, just kind of all casual. I'm taking my talents to the NBA.
Jones, you probably remember this. Like, at that time, like, people in the NBA were like, what is this kid? This kid thinks he can play in the NBA?
Yeah.
Because the only person who had done the jump was Garnett, and he was still fairly young. But if you remember, there were all these old school types who were like, how dare this guy not go to Duke, Who does he think he is? Yep. He can't play in this league. Yep. And, you know, now 2020.
Like, oh, and he came off the bench to start, too.
Yeah, yeah. The world has flipped. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I even think today, like, just it's amazing. This is where human scouting is always is flawed. Like, it's amazing the guy went eighth.
He was 13th.
13th. Amazing.
13th to Charlotte.
That's 13th. Incredible. So 12 and, teams passed on him.
And you hear, you know, Tim Legler from ESPN, who was in Philly. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, he's a LaSalle guy. And said that Kobe used to play in the pickup games with the pros. And Legler said when he was like a junior in high school, he goes, this kid's going to be a star in the NBA. And they're like, oh, come on, really? And he's like, no, like this kid's this. And you're right, Deitch, 13th. 13th for the Charlotte Hornets.
I'm going to ask you guys, this is going to be hard to do. Leave aside the 81. Hmm. Forget that game for a minute. We'll talk. But your. When I say Kobe Bryant to you, what do you envision? Again, leaving aside the 81, Jonesy, which I know is hard to do.
But. I envision a guy who is so competitive that other people will wonder what's wrong with him.
How do you?
With his competitive nature on the floor. Like, people would say, easy, buddy, it's just a game. And it's not just a game to him. And his competitiveness and you know, scoring points and like pulling his jersey back and like just willing his team. Like in the year that they came back from down 3-2 against Boston, mm-hmm. in game 6 and game 7, those were two of the ugliest basketball games I had ever seen. They were, to me, reminiscent of the Rockets and the Knicks 79-73. Like there was grabbing and clutching and holding. And if you've ever played pickup, when the game's up to 7 and it's like 5-all and you're calling your own fouls, it's like you might as well be playing rugby out there.
Right.
Like score from center, because if you get close to the basket, it's not happening.
Well, they let him play.
And yeah, they did. They let him play. And that game, with everybody else doing what they did, Kobe still found a way to get the Lakers a win. It was one of the ugliest, and he would be the first one to walk off and say, who won? Mm-hmm. Like, you can complain about the aesthetics of it all and whatever, and he would say, okay, well, who won? The end justifies the means. Mm. That's what I think of, this competitive guy that is almost to the point where people would say, what an...
Yeah.
Insert expletive here.
Was at times.
And he was. Yeah. But, and it was all in the competitive framework of winning.
You know, and I'll kind of piggyback on that, but I think I'll think most of the early era Kobe, and not to say that the later era Kobe was any worse, but Shaq and Kobe specifically, and that tandem, and how they were just this force of nature on and off the floor. They were unstoppable most times together on the floor, and they were
polar opposites, really.
Polar opposites and unstoppable off the floor for a whole lot of completely different reasons. And just to think of how they were able to coexist with their two respective egos and the skill set, and to make it work between the lines, but then have such animosity or edge tension between the two of them, and then to be able to find a way through that to the point where, and I heard you guys talking about where their relationship did evolve into a friendship, into a family, into, you know, my children are your nieces and nephews and vice versa and whatnot, and the maturity that they showed in their relationship to move beyond what they once were, and to think of what they could have been even more so had they actually stayed together longer. That's what I'll remember. Is, I mean, as fun and as great as the Showtime era was as a kid watching that team, it was as good or better watching that 1-2 punch of Kobe and Shaq together.
And everybody remembers Christmas Day when Miami went out to play in LA and Shaq was dapping up everybody, and you got to Kobe and just walked by him. And it was like this was like real life family feud. I mean, you know, here's everybody watching it on national TV.
Well, I mean, there's a lot that will always stand out with him. To me, like the pathological attention to detail, footwork, improving your shot every year, making sure guys are in the right spots, making sure you cut correctly. Like the And then actually went on after his career was over to host a show called Detail, I think, on ESPN Plus, which is sort of about the details of that. So that stands out. And then if in terms of a singular play, and this is the same for Jordan for me, is, you know, you can point to a million possessions with those guys scoring a game-winning basket or, you know, Michael's shot over Byron Russell or whatever you pick. But, like, for me, the two things that I love about Jordan and Kobe that always stand out in my mind are passes. Jordan's pass to Kerr, of course, one. And two, Kobe's lob to Shaq.
Against Portland.
Against the Kings.
Against the Kings. We were talking about Scott.
I thought you were going to Portland when they
game
came
seven
back.
Against Sacramento, right?
Yeah, against game seven against Sacramento.
The one you see all the time.
Gives it a five-point lead, and then Shaq does his, like, windmill around the court. And Kobe points to him, and they sort of fist bump. It's a reminder to me that and you guys see this every day in the NBA, like, the greatest of scorers, the ones who are truly great, find other ways to win. This is one of the things I love about Kawhi this year. He's become a great passer. And so Jordan and Kobe, as all-time greats, could beat you even if they didn't have the ball at the end. So I always, you know, that pass is one of the most famous plays in history, and it's sort of when I think of Kobe Bryant, that's the play, I think.
Does that single-mindedness explain why Kobe Bryant was able to, after that incident in Eagle, Colorado, the sexual assault, he lost some sponsors, but as we've talked about, man, he turned into one of the game's grand old men. 2 years later, you saw young girls courtside wearing Kobe Bryant jerseys.
It does, Blair. I think he was able to
just put your head down and go, man.
Revive his image. I mean, think of what he was going through when the trial was going on. He was flying back and forth.
I'd forgotten about that.
He'd be in court and then get on a private plane and fly back, walk into the gym like half an hour before the game and then drop 50. He had a run there of 40-point games, and it was like, people are like, this is unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
But that single-mindedness, I think it did help bring him back, regardless of, you know, how you feel about the suit. And like, there was a civil case that was settled for an undisclosed settlement after. He that's his personality. And that single-mindedness is what was going to, as we say, make the next act of Kobe what it is. It's why he won an Academy Award.
Yep.
It's why there's the Mamba Institute, it's why he was writing children's books. Whatever it was, he was going to go at it full bore. And if it meant reshaping his image, then he was doing that.
I wanted to piggyback on that for a second too, because I was reading an article, and I don't know if any of you even know the story, but I had obviously forgotten it, because when I believe it was in the Washington Post, and it came out last fall. For those that don't know this whole Black Mamba, Mamba, Mamba mentality, the genesis of that is him sitting down and turning on the television one night, and he happens upon Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill.
Yeah.
And there's a scene in Kill Bill where the snake comes out, and I think it's Daryl Hannah's character, and the snake comes out from under a book or something, kills the other character in the movie. And it was the Black Mamba.
Black Mamba.
And from that point forward, Kobe said, just like, he researched what the Black Mamba snake
most
was, how deadly and how dangerous it was. And I don't want to get too, you know, out there and poetic and prophetic and everything else with it, but it certainly does seem like the shedding of the skin, leaving behind the early year Kobe and leaving behind the brash, the sassy, the attitude, the arrogance, the cockiness that you were speaking of, leaving behind, right, wrong, or otherwise, whatever happened. You know, we used to say only two people really know what happened in that hotel room, and unfortunately now there's only one, what really went down. But shedding the skin and evolving into a new man. And I can't sit here and say with any sort of authority whether he ever cheated on his wife again, whether he truly lived a good and golden life and walked the straight path every day. But what we certainly saw was a different man on the floor. We saw a different teammate. And post-career, we certainly saw a different person.
You know, right.
And we saw a father that had four daughters that wanted nothing to do with himself and was promoting his children.
Very loving. Very loving.
And wanted to be a coach and a dad and a mentor more than former NBA player or Hall of Fame or whatever. And that, to me, was a sign of that shedding of the skin and becoming something new.
He was one of those guys. Fatherhood looked really, really, really good on him.
Yeah.
It really looked good on him.
Well, I mean, they talk about it too, right? When he changed numbers. How was Kobe number 8 different from Kobe number 24? And it it speaks to a lot of the things that Eric talked
about. We are going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about what the NBA can do to honor Kobe Bryant. It's Writer's Block, the Monday Roundtable on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Absolutely free. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
I put my heart and soul in this game. I'm feeling drained, unappreciated, unalleviated. Tired of coming up short.
All right, welcome back to the Monday Roundtable on Writer's Block. It is Eric Smith, Paul Jones, Richard Deitch, and Jeff Blair. I want to talk about what you think the NBA will do to honor Kobe Bryant. We already know that he's apparently going, he's going to go into the Hall of Fame.
His 5-year term is... would start this year anyway.
Oh, it would start.
Yeah,
okay.
He would have been in the Hall of Fame.
He would have been in the Hall of Fame anyhow. What do you think the league's going to do? You know, there was talk about retiring the number 24. The Dallas Mavericks have already said, at least Mark Cuban's already said, nobody's wearing 24. What does the league do to, like, what happens to bring closure to this, Jonesy?
I don't know, Jeff. And I saw that Mark Cuban in Dallas, the 24, and to me, that's different from baseball, where baseball retired 42.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier.
Right.
And in that time, I'm not downplaying Kobe's death, but that was a social statement as mm-hmm. well. And look at what it's led to. Although, 8% of African Americans now play baseball? That's it? I think there should be some, I don't know what, though. I think there should be something done league-wide to honor him. Like, it's interesting. When we go to games in Miami, you look up in the rafters, Jordan's number's retired, 45.
Yep. Right.
Not 23, 45.
45, yeah.
And they've got a jersey up there. Like, I think the league, I don't know what, though. Like, they've got to do something to honor him, but to get kind of a universal consensus from everybody in the league, that could be tough.
I'd have no problem with retiring 24. And Norm Powell, for what it's worth, did tell us yesterday in the locker room that if that ultimately came down, he'd have no problem giving up 24 and he'd just find a new number. He was very matter of fact. That's why he wears 24. He said, if that's going to be the ultimate honor, then I'll take it off gladly and switch. But I saw Chris Mannix write this yesterday. And I believe it's his original idea and I liked it. He said, at least in the short term, what they could do for the All-Star weekend in Chicago is whomever decides, Team LeBron wears 24. Every player on the team wears 24.
Yeah,
and Team Giannis, everybody wears number 8.
That
would be one way. And then perhaps you take the MVP of the All-Star game and rename it the Kobe Bryant Trophy, the Kobe Bryant Award.
Yeah,
because you've already got the Finals MVP, you know, named after Bill Russell.
Right.
But that would be one way to have something that stands
like that.
The test of time. And a guy who was an 18-time All-Star in his 20-year career.
Just real quick, one thing to watch for, just sort of outside the box thing, if they ever get that in-season tournament, Kobe Bryant.
Which I hope they never have.
Kobe Bryant Trophy for that in-season tournament.
Right.
How do you think Kobe Bryant would like the in-season tournament?
It's terrible. I hope it never happens.
Well, I don't know if he'd like it, but if he was in it, he'd try his darndest to win it.
Exactly.
Just before you let you run, we got 2.5 minutes here. I want to ask on air what I asked you guys off air, because Michael's a great competitor. Kobe's a great competitor. Who was the better competitor of the two, Jonesy?
As I said when we were off air, I think Kobe's competitiveness was more overt because of the era of accessibility of sports TV. Like, Michael was just at the start of that, and we saw his greatness and his competitiveness, but we didn't see it the way you could watch Kobe do it every night. I would have trouble picking one over the other, because they are both legendary to the point where you could, as I said earlier, insert an expletive to use as a descriptor of them, because they wanted to win so badly. Like, there are stories out there about Jordan and, like, off the court too,
golf,
like knocking on Chuck Daly's door in Barcelona, like, and like, we're playing 36 holes. It's like, well, wait a minute, we're playing Angola tonight. Don't worry about it. Like, you know, you got my money from yesterday. Let's So we didn't hear about any of that with Kobe. I don't know. Maybe he was a card player or something. But if you ask me, one or the other, Jeff, I would have problems picking.
I'll pick Kobe only because he wanted so badly to be Michael, to be as good, if not better than Michael. So if they're, if we're saying that their careers and their competitiveness are on even axis, what maybe steers it a bit for me is the drive that Kobe had so bad to be better than that guy, and or at least be that guy, from the tongue wag to the chew of the gum to the way he walked to his fadeaway shot to everything he did to emulate MJ. That is what, just by a hair, maybe puts him a tick ahead.
And he still has one less ring, though.
Yeah,
right?
No doubt.
And that's what Jordan would say. Yep. I got six.
That's right.
Yep.
That's exactly what you say. Guys, thanks so much for doing this. I know it was a long day yesterday. I really appreciate this. And again, well
pleasure
done yesterday.
Here. Pleasure.
Paul
to be
Jones
here.
And Eric Smith joining Richard Deitch and myself, the Monday Roundtable. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a great night, everybody.